Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. In this appeal, the appellant Broadmeadow is asking the court to determine whether a certificate of public review granted to a quasi-public entity which is operating in the public interest and pursuant to a state regulatory scheme constitutes a property interest, as that term has come to be known in constitutional jurisprudence, and if it is, what consequences flow from that decision. The grant of a CPR, which we also used to be known as a CON, Certificate of Need, in Chapter 93 of Title 16, in addition to the general licensure requirements set forth in Chapter 11 of Title 16, creates a relationship between the grantee and the state, which involves several elements. One, a high capital outlay of a permanent nature by the grantee in order to build the facility. Two, the provision of services which are inherently public in nature. Three, a restriction on the discretion of the state to revoke those licenses as set forth in the statutes. And four, ongoing regulation by the state, including the ability to require that the grantee submit to certain conditions, including mandatory charity care. Now, these four factors are the indicia of a franchise. And while the focus of the CPR law is cost, access, and quality of area health care services provided to the citizenry, the state achieves that goal by regulating competition. And in this manner, it protects the interests of existing CPR holders as well as the general public.
Well, you say it's an indicia of a franchise.
Yes.
But not of an exclusive franchise.
No, it is not an exclusive franchise. We certainly concede that point. But not having an exclusivity does not deny it other rights. And that leads me to my next point. The rights that are granted come with the CPR are, of course, the right to build the healthcare facility, the right not to have the CPR revoked or amended at the will of the state, but only according to certain statutorily enumerated factors, the right to require that any other entrant into the geographic area go through the CPR process, and the right that any CPR that is granted to any new entrant be pursuant to a fair and lawful process in conformance with the statutory scheme.
Well, the argument, as I understand it, that would reply initially to yours is Broadmeadow got that at the administrative hearing. And in Delaware, unlike a majority of states, a person in Broadmeadow's, or entity in Broadmeadow's position doesn't have standing to take an appeal. Now, whether that's the right decision or not, I take it you concede that the statute limits the appeal to the applicant.
No, Your Honor, we have said in our third argument on our brief that if the statute does not, apart from a subheading, identify who may appeal, and under Title I, subheadings are not part of the statute, and that there are principles of statutory construction that state that being a remedial statute is to be construed liberally and in favor of appeal rights to both sides. And applying those principles of statutory construction.
But you would limit those to an entity like Broadmeadow, who already held a CON or whatever it's now called. I can't.
A CPR or a CON.
CPR strikes me as somebody rushing in and manipulating my heart. But my history is a CON. But in any event, that doesn't open up to the neighborhood members who object to having a facility in their neighborhood as potential appellees. It's limited to entities like Broadmeadow who you argue have a property interest. Is that correct?
Your Honor, had I my druthers, I would argue that it should open to the citizenry because the citizenry are the ones most affected by health care costs, which this is designed to protect. However, for the purposes of this appeal, what I am arguing is that my client, having a property interest, invokes constitutional protection or right of appeal.
Well, that is what I think needs clarification. We understand, or at least I understand, that the property interest argument is a constitutional argument. But are you making a separate statutory argument apart from the constitutional argument, or are the two in effect being blended together here.
No, Your Honor. Thank you for allowing me to respond to that. There are two separate arguments. We are stating that, one, we have a property interest. And then, first of all, I should do it in reverse order because, obviously, the court, if it doesn't need to reach the constitutional argument, doesn't have to. What we are saying is that if you look at the statute says appeal dash dash.
You're saying the statute should be construed to confer standing on someone in your client's position.
Correct, Your Honor.
Not the public at large, but at least someone, an objector who happens to hold an existing CON or CPR or whatever you call it.
That's correct, Your Honor. We have cited in our briefs a number of cases which hold that apart from the constitutional issues.
Putting aside, assuming that there's no constitutional dimension to this case at this point, what's your statutory argument?
The statutory argument is that the body of the statute itself does not identify who may appeal. The word applicant appears in a subheading. It says appeal dash dash applicant period, and then goes into the text. And under the provision of Title I, it says that headings and subheadings are not part of the law. And therefore, if you take that rule and you also apply the rule of statutory interpretation that remedial statutes are to be construed liberally and appeal rights are to be inferred.
What makes this a remedial statute?
Because it allows, it provides a remedy for an aggrieved party to come to court and challenge the decision of the administrative agency.
But the General Assembly amended the statute after Superior Court decisions limiting appeals to the applicant and did not address this anomaly, for lack of a better word. Doesn't that suggest a legislative intent to leave it that way?
I would respectfully counter that with the fact that they also did not amend the provision of Title I, which says that subheadings are not part of the law. They might have assumed the court would
the case law. Case law is relevant, isn't it?
Case law is relevant, and the court can go that way. This court has not ruled on that point yet, and we are saying that the case law has made those points, has not taken into account the points that I'm bringing before the court today, particularly the principles of statutory construction.
Would you address what I read from the three Superior Court cases, which is, despite your argument to construe the statute liberally because it's a remedial statute, they look at the heading and say, we agree the Title I statute says it's not part of the law, but it's illustrative of the appropriate construction of the statute itself. Why is that an incorrect position to take?
Because it does not take into account these other principles, countervailing principles of statutory construction that we provided to the court. And for that reason, I respectfully suggest that those countervailing principles outweigh the value of the subheading.
What Justice Risley's point about the General Assembly presumptively knows what the case law has said and they haven't changed the statute, does that also apply? The General Assembly must know that they put Delaware in the minority of states in limiting appeals to the applicant only, arguably, and they still haven't changed the statute. Should that impress us in any way?
As I stand here, I cannot say, and I don't want to be disagreeable, but I cannot say that they do know what the canvassed law of other states are when they adopt their statute.
Well, it's probable that Broadmeadow didn't bring it to their attention because Broadmeadow was the winner on this precise point in an earlier Superior Court case, didn't they?
And in the earlier Superior Court case, Your Honor, the opposite party was not as far as we could tell, an existing con holder with property rights. And Your Honor, as I heard a story once, that Abe Lincoln was faced in a similar position before a judge where he argued the opposite position, and the judge said, "How can you do that?" And apocryphally, perhaps, but President Lincoln said, "Well, with age comes wisdom." times have passed.
He didn't say, I changed my mind.
No. I think he did, but more eloquently. There has been a change of position. It's the same entity's different ownership at that time, just a different ownership of HealthSouth now than before.
Well, Mr. Finger, just to follow up, I'm still trying to understand the statutory arc, the pure statutory interpretation argument. And so far, what you've told us is this statute is remedial, therefore what?
Therefore, it is to be construed liberally.
What does that mean?
That means that where there's nothing specific identifying in the body of the statute who may appeal.
I mean, what chain of logic, the falling under the rubric of liberal construction gets you to, or gets us to construe the statute so as to include anyone other than the party, you know, a person who was a party to the proceedings below.
Well, I respond in two ways. First, if one takes the other word, restrictive, I would say it would be restrictive to limit it to one party, and therefore it would be.
Well, I think there has to be some limitations here because, if you take liberal construction to its extreme, it could include the whole world.
That is
what
true.
What limiting principle, would guide our liberal construction? And this is just as a matter of pure statutory interpretation, forgetting constitutional considerations.
Yes. Well, then the question would be not so much whether somebody else can, but how do I think Your Honor's question is how do you limit who can?
I will be satisfied with a set of deductive principles that get you, to some, some okay. limited class other than the rest of the world, or even parties, including objectors, including potential objectors.
Mm-hmm. I would answer that. Then we would apply the common law standing rules. And we cited in our reply brief a number of cases which hold that a existing healthcare facility in the geographic area, by virtue of being there and by virtue of being a competitor and being able to represent the public interest more capably than an individual to whom an individual harm may be too expensive.
So anyone who has an interest in the outcome?
Yes. Yes. In those cases, in the vast majority of those cases, the courts have held by virtue of that, they have standing. They are within the zone of interest protected by the statute. I want to turn now to the Delaware Constitution because I believe that this matter can be decided under the Delaware Constitution without going to federal principles. Article 1, Section 9, the open courts provision, states that any person suffering an injury, the courts have access to the courts. And no Delaware case has interpreted that provision as restricting the right based on the strength or nature of the property interest involved. It merely says that there's a right to seek a remedy for an injury. And the term injury is not modified or restricted in any way. And the phrase any person or every person is not restricted or modified. That's about as broad and clear and unambiguous as it gets. The trial court said that applying federal principles said that there had to be a total deprivation. That was the only injury that would satisfy the federal constitution. And, of course, we cited several U.S. Supreme Court cases subsequent to that to show that that was incorrect. However, this court need not resolve the dispute because the term injury in our Constitution is not synonymous with the word deprived that appears in the U.S. Constitution. And a total deprivation is an injury, but not all injuries are total deprivations. And so while the phrase the law of the land in Article 1, Section 9 has been interpreted as being analogous to the term due process in the 14th Amendment, the 14th Amendment does not provide any guidance to the interpretation of the word injury. much less indicate any restrictive interpretation. The injury to my client in this case is issuing a CPR in what we claim was a violation of the administrative statutory scheme and due process. If that is proven ultimately in resolving the merits of the argument, that is an injury not merely to my client, but to all citizens who will benefit from the statute.
Mr. Finger, is it correct that your client does have a remedy, but it would be outside of this process? That is, it would be a court of chancery action?
Your Honor, we don't know the answer to that. And the reason we don't know the answer to that is because there would be an argument that the administrative process, if we have that, is an adequate remedy at law.
Well, it would not be an adequate remedy at law, at least arguably, if your client has no right to participate in the appeal.
That's exactly right. And if this court were to hold...
Then, and in that case, would you not have a chancery remedy, either by way of declaratory judgment or injunctive relief?
Yes, Your Honor. If we had the remedy, and the Frost case, the United States Supreme Court talked about that, we cite that in our... Excuse me, Your Honor?
The answer is yes?
Yes, the answer is yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And we would be happy with that.
So what we're really talking about, at least what's at stake for your client, is whether it proceeds in the appeal in the Superior Court or whether it files an original action with the Court of Chancery. To put the question non-legally, what's the big deal? Why are we here if your client could simply... seek relief in the Court of Chancery?
Because the reason this is initiated is because of the time limitations for administrative process. If we could go to the Court of Chancery, if we had not done this, gone to the Court of Chancery, get thrown out because they say you have an administrative remedy, then it's too late. And we have put ourselves, if this court were to hold that we still have, that the administrative process does not foreclose seeking original action in the Court of Chancery, we'd be very satisfied with that.
Do you contend that the administrative agency below failed to follow its own procedures?
We do, Your Honor. And I don't know that it might be beyond the scope to go into the merits of that. We do make that allegation in our notice of appeal.
Are you familiar with the Louisiana State Supreme Court case, Greenbrier Nursing Home versus Piley?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay.
I wanted to turn to go back to the, if I may, again, we were talking about Article 1, Section 9, and the interpretation of the phrase every person as providing an equal protection argument, essentially. I think it's clear the Delaware, this court has said in an earlier decision that it is a violation of the state as well as federal Supreme Court to grant one party appeal rights but not another party.
Well, you used the word party.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor.
So you'll explain to us how your client is a party.
I will again refer, Your Honor, to the decision of this court in A.I. DuPont versus Delaware Alcoholic Beverage Control Commission, a 1975 decision. At 343 A second 600, specifically at page 604, the court held that by participating in the administrative procedure and submitting a written objection, they became parties. And we've also cited other cases from other jurisdictions in conformity with that decision. It is nomenclature, Your Honor. They were actively adversarial in the court in the administrative party below, and therefore. It elevates, I respectfully submit, form above substance to say that they were not parties.
Now that opens the door to the neighbors who object because of the traffic flow interfering with the raising of goats in their backyards or something like that. If they show up, object, and they're recognized as an objector, and as all good administrative agencies typically do, they want to please the public, so they'll let anybody talk about anything as irrelevant as it may be to the process. Just to make everybody go home happy. So would that open the floodgates, that theory, that if you're recognized as an objector, absent any property right or interest financially in the outcome,
no,
you
won't
be able to appeal because you are recognized as an objector?
No, Your Honor, I think at that point, the point that Justice Jacobs made previously comes into play here. There's still the zone of interest requirement under common law standing, which I think would protect against an abuse of that right. Now, I have a couple of minutes left, and I would like to address, finally, on the equal protection argument. The trial court said there is a rational basis for disparate treatment because denying appeal rights to one party would save the courts from having to deal with technical issues. However, I respectfully suggest that that is not rational because it doesn't change the nature of the issues that can come before the Superior Court on appeals. It just limits the parties who can raise them. An unsuccessful applicant could appeal and still raise technical issues that broad matter could raise under the circumstances. So that is not really a rational basis. Moreover, the existing administrative jurisprudence has a series of rules in place which limit that which can be brought before the Superior Court on an appeal from an administrative agency. So it is not a rational basis reasonably related to the goals sought to be achieved. And finally, the appellees have raised a new argument. They're saying, well, there's a rational basis to keep out Broadmeadow because they've been granted the CPR and they're being inhibited. They would be inhibited from being able to begin construction. Well, the problem with that is that creates its own equal protection problem because there are a variety of other cases, real estate cases, zoning cases, intellectual property cases, where the winner would like to go forward with whatever process they want to go forward and expend and lay out money or start construction, but the other side appeals. So why do we allow it in one class of cases, but not in this class of case? So that compounds the problem rather than solves the problem.
And, we have about 3 minutes left. Did you want to save it for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court.
Could I interrupt right at the outset? I'm curious as to whether you agree with appellant's view about the availability of a remedy in the Court of Chancery.
I do not, Your Honor, at least in the circumstances of this case. 9308, which is the section that authorizes the what I think of as the Chancery remedy, the injunctive remedy, is a targeted remedy designed to address the issue of a rogue operator operating without a CON. There is no dispute here that HealthSouth has, I call it a CON too, Chief Justice, a CPR. There's no dispute that HealthSouth has a CON. There's no dispute that there was a long and public process involved in the issuance of that, CPR. And there is, or at least I'm going to posit, there is no real dispute that the General Assembly made a judgment that after that long and public process designed in Chapter 93, only certain entities have the right to appeal.
The statute that you're referring to is tailored to this category of cases. Or are you talking about
the statute I refer to specifically, Justice Jacobs, with Section 9308, is the statute that authorizes any adversely affected healthcare facility or the board to seek an injunction from Chancery against an operator who is operating without the required certificate.
All right. So you're saying
different situation than this case.
Okay. Under that statute, your position is that this particular party or non-party, as the case may be, would not qualify.
I do take that position, yes. I think it's on the face of the statute.
However, apart from the statute, a line of cases that hold that where there is no right of appeal or no remedy at law by way of a right of appeal from an adverse decision of an administrative board, the adversely affected party is entitled to bring an action in the Court of Chancery if it can allege that the action of the agency was arbitrary and capricious. I'm thinking of the highway, the Department of Transportation bidding cases and the matters which are not covered.
Your Honor, I'm familiar generally with that line of cases. That is the standard, as I understand, and I am now digging back into my memory. That is the standard. That is, it would require a finding of arbitrary or capricious behavior by the agency.
I'm just raising the question of, apart from the statute that you were discussing, under that line of authority, assuming that Broadmeadow could allege within the purview of Rule 11 that the action that was taken or not taken was arbitrary and capricious, it would have that route to relief, would it not?
Your Honor, let me just say, I believe I'm familiar with that line of cases. I have not reviewed them. That is not an issue that was raised on this appeal. And so although I, as a general proposition, I do have some recollection of that line, I believe it's a very, very limited line, and I do believe it requires a very high bar for the statute. So I can't unequivocally say that it would be available to Broadmeadow, although I suppose it would help my argument if I could say that.
What about a writ of certiorari? Would that be available?
You know, Justice Ridgely, this does raise in my mind a somewhat broader question. The suggestion has been made that there is no means of review of a board action in this case, since of a grant of a CPR in this case, because if the applicant receives its CPR and the applicant is the only authorized party for an appeal, there's a limited chance that there will be an appeal. I think that's wrong, and I think the certificate of certiorari, the application for a writ of certiorari is one such avenue of review. We happen to believe that in this case it's a high bar to get a grant of a writ, and we believe in this case Broadmeadow, which has filed an application for such a writ, hasn't cleared that bar, but it is certainly an alternative way to address, for example, the question of, which is not present in this case, a rogue board that simply ignores the advice of the Attorney General that it is not complying with its own regulations. The writ might lie in that circumstance, and so that's another, Justice Jacobs has suggested that at least on an arbitrary and capricious standard, there might be a remedy in Chancery.
Suggest that the administrative agency below failed to follow its own administrative procedures. That would be the kind of argument that you would put in a petition for a writ of certiorari, the fact that the record shows that the law was not followed.
I can imagine that would be what you might put in a petition for a writ. That kind of an allegation, as Mr. Finger forthrightly conceded, is not present in this appeal. But I have to say, the kinds of allegations that have been thrown around in the brief without supporting record citations are unfortunate. I suppose there's not a need to respond because they're not before the court today. And I do agree with you, Chief Justice, that that is the kind of extreme allegation that might support the grant of a writ of certiorari. It would have to be coupled, in my view, with some protectable property interest, but that's for a different court and a different proceeding than today's proceeding. I take it there are two basic arguments from Broadmeadow. The first is that Section 93058 explicitly grants Broadmeadow the right to an appeal, and that argument is based on, I think, a tortured reading of the statute. It is an argument also that would, I think, grant standing to appeal to anyone, because what it seeks to do is to read out of Section 93058 the limiting language that was formerly in the text, remains in the heading, and which Justice Quillen and others following Justice Quillen's analysis in Arbor has found indicates the clear intent of the General Assembly to limit appeal rights to the applicant in those circumstances. if that limitation is read out, I think that would open the floodgates to anybody, not just a person who claims a particular state-granted property right, but as I think it was you, Chief Justice, said, well, you know, anybody who's got a problem with the traffic outside of his door. The arguments against that interpretation are, I think, pretty clear, and the bench has indicated, I think, an understanding of those arguments, including the statutory construction arguments advanced in Arbor and Nanticoke and adopted below. I would like to just simply reference what I think of as the legislative ratification argument that was also the subject of a question here. I think it's been now five times that the General Assembly has taken up Chapter 93 since the Arbor decision, and in each case it has failed. I think the presumption is it has decided consciously not to change Section 93058 in the light of the analysis in Arbor, Nanticoke, and elsewhere. That is a powerful indication of exactly what the General Assembly thinks is the correct balance to be struck between the policy considerations that might limit or that might constrain unlimited appeals by anyone of this type of decision, and the competing policy consideration that there ought to be, in some circumstances, in the General Assembly's judgment, review of a decision by the board.
But you would agree, wouldn't you, that if the court determines that appellant has a property interest with respect to the CER, that it would be appropriate to construe the statute as allowing an appeal, because if the statute didn't, it would be unconstitutional?
Yes, Justice Berger, I do agree with that. I think that there is the second argument, if I can move off the statutory interpretation argument, which seems to be well joined in the briefs and with the court. Let's turn to the constitutional issue. Yes.
Follow up on Justice Berger's question, and this really gets to what the Superior Court held. Did the Superior Court hold that CON or CPR was not a property interest at all, or did it hold that it was a property interest, but the adverse ruling that it received was not a constitutional diminution of that interest or deprivation of that interest? That is, to say it differently, does the analysis end once you find that the certificate that Broadmeadow holds is a property interest? Do you have to inquire further into the nature?
I think you have to inquire further into the nature of the interest. I don't think.
So the answer to your question, to Justice Berger's question, would be that the mere finding of a property interest doesn't get you, doesn't yield an unconstitutionality.
That's exactly true. It depends on the nature of the property interest. We don't contend that a certificate of need is not something that was conferred by the state.
It may be a property right of some kind.
It is a right of some kind. It is, in effect, and let me try to simplify the way I'll explain how I think about this and necessarily what I think is the right way to think about this. There are all kinds of licenses granted by the state. For our purposes, the question is whether the license is exclusive, in which case our cases often talk about it as a franchise rather than a license. If the right that is granted is exclusive, it is competition-free, then to grant a competing license changes the character of that property interest. The original holder formerly had a competition-free right and no longer does. That's not our case.
If it were your case, then to follow up on Justice Berger's question, we would have to construe the statute as conferring standing. Otherwise, there would be an unconstitutional deprivation.
I think that's correct, Justice Jacobs, but I would point out that Mr. Finger, again, forthrightly conceded, this is not an exclusive license. So that's, as I said, that's not our case. Our case is...
Is the absence of an exclusive license the end to any discussion about one's constitutional rights?
No. For example, to take a more homely example, state authority grant taxi licenses all the time. That taxi license, though it is not exclusive, nevertheless represents an interest granted to the holder. And the state can't arbitrarily simply revoke that property interest. In that circumstance, the taxi driver might well have some due process rights. But the taxi driver's license is not affected in any way. The character of what the state has given the taxi driver is not affected in any way by the grant of another taxi license. And so there is nothing to be protected because nothing has been changed. There's been no revocation. So to your question, Justice Jacobs, or it's really your question, I guess, Justice Berger, it is not the end of the inquiry to say, is this an exclusive right? But it is a step on the way to consider whether due process rights attach to this interest in the context of this state action.
All right. Well, here's the way I'm looking at it. The right to or having obtained a CPR, as was pointed out, includes a variety of responsibilities that the healthcare provider has to assume. And it also, if I understand it correctly, includes a finding by the board that this medical facility is needed in this particular location, which to me at least suggests that if somebody wanted to get a CPR for the place next door to me, the proximity would be an issue that would affect the original CPR owner's business significantly. Why isn't that, even though it's not an exclusive franchise, why isn't that a basis on which a holder of a CPR is entitled to say, we want to appeal because our interest in being able to run a successful business is being impaired?
Well, I think the answer to that is the original CPR, in Broadmeadow's case, it's 1995 CON, always contemplated that there could be competitive activities that, as a collateral effect, might impact the business of Broadmeadow. Always contemplated that.
Right, but didn't it always also contemplate that there would be some spacing out, that there would be consideration of the community's need, which translates into how much business the facility would be able to do?
I don't know if I'm saying something differently, but what I would say is it was always subject to the notion that, subject to the law at the time that the new competitor enters, which right now involves a CPR review, a competitor could enter, but there would have to be, it would have to jump through whatever hoops existed at the time the competitor entered. No guarantees about what those hoops would be, no guarantees about what the result of whatever review was necessary might be. The certificate of need was granted in 1995 based on the circumstances at that time, and I would agree with Your Honor that it was subject to the notion that competitors could always enter, but if a competitor entered and there was at the time of the entry some regulatory requirement, as there was in this case, that the regulatory requirement would be satisfied. It was satisfied in this case, and the question now is whether Broadmeadow, as a non-applicant, in contravention of the General Assembly's judgment and balance striking, can now take an appeal from that process in which it was an active participant, in which it testified, in which it submitted a written opposition, in which not only Broadmeadow but many other entities also participated. And the argument that is advanced in the briefs is, yes, we can, because we have a right not to be competed with unless a proper CON process is undertaken, and we get to tell you whether the process that was undertaken is proper or not.
Well, I think what they're saying is that the court gets to tell you.
But that puts the rabbit in the hat, Justice Berger. That means that any appellant, any potential appellant, hopeful appellant, can say, I think that the certificate of need, the CPR process, was flawed. And since I have a right to be not to be subject to competition unless it's pursuant to an unflawed CPR process, I've got an appeal right, because that's my it's tortuous, I think, but that's my created exclusivity. That's why the character of my certificate has been changed.
Well, there's,
but who gets to make that decision?
There's one element that we really haven't touched on, and I want you to clear up for me whether it's still part of the certificate of need or whatever process. It used to be, anyway. And that is the viability of the entity economically to continue to provide the need to the community that resulted in the original certificate of need being issued. So when competition comes in, first there's a question of whether it's genuinely competing or not. Does a CAT scan compete with an MRI kind of issue? But the second issue is the effect of the new entrant on the ability of the existing licensee to economically, viably continue to provide what has been established as a need to the community is also a consideration. Now, to me, it's arguable that that's an integral part of the property right argument. You're not driving me out of business because you're presenting a better product or one that might be more successful than my closed MRI, which claustrophobes don't want to visit, as opposed to a donut CAT scan, which they do. But you do have a license to provide the service, and shouldn't the inquiry continue to be the economic viability of that license given the new prospective entrant? And if the party who's concerned about their continued economic viability in providing that need has no option to challenge the issuance of the CON to the new kid on the block, so to speak, doesn't that adversely affect their property right? And in some extent, the integrity of the certificate of need process altogether?
Well,
that's a long question, I admit.
Let me begin my answer to that question by saying, Chief Justice, that I am not a lawyer well-versed in the CPR process. I've learned a lot in the course of preparing for this argument, but I would say this. The question of need necessarily involves some consideration of whether the current need, whether the needs of the existing patient slash customer base are being satisfied. That is to say, a judgment would be made about need and a judgment be made that there is need only if that need is currently not being satisfied. And so I think, again, I'm no expert in this area, but I think that the process, I think logically and necessarily, does include some consideration of what Your Honor has asked about. I would then continue, Chief Justice, by saying, I think that a certificate of need is granted subject to whatever the circumstances are at the time a new competitor may seek to enter. There are many states, for example, not Delaware, but many states that have gotten rid of essentially the CPR and CON requirement. If Delaware were that state, I can imagine that and Delaware abolished Chapter 93. I can imagine HealthSouth hasn't done this. HealthSouth has jumped through the hoops it's supposed to. But I can imagine people competing, and I can't imagine in the absence of a CPR process that Broadmeadow would have any remedy. That's not our case. Broadmeadow has a terrific remedy here.
Well, my my background may be a bit stale on this. It's been a few years since I was a practicing lawyer, but I thought that because of concerns about the cost of Medicare and Medicaid, that government insisted on this process. And by government, I mean the all-powerful Python on the Potomac. I don't mean the state government.
Your Honor, I think I certainly would not suggest that my knowledge is greater than yours, but I believe it is true that there have been recent decisions finding the whole CPR process in some states to be unconstitutional, and they've been struck down. But I'm now at the extreme limits of my knowledge in this area.
Well, that would be a new development, so I will withdraw my further comment on that.
I see that my time is up, but if the court has other questions, I'm happy to respond.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry about that.
Please continue.
Good afternoon.
Despite Justice Holland's consideration that you should start, I would prefer we start when he returns.
Are you sure? Because we still have a quorum.
I'm positive. More positive than I am about many things.
Good afternoon. Patricia Davis Oliva, Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of the Health Resources Management Board. Picking up with the Chief Justice's most recent question, Congress, when it enacted the National Health Planning and Resources Development Act in 1975, did require states to implement a CON process. The NHPA, however, was repealed by Congress in 1987. However, the federal government permitted the states to continue with their certificate of need process in the state's discretion. Delaware elected to continue with the certificate of need process, and the objective of the Health Resources Management Board, as spelled out in its enabling statute, is not only to address possible adverse consequences to the cost of health care in Delaware, but also to regulate any development that may threaten the ability of a facility to provide services to the medically indigent. And thus, the Health Resources Management Board has an even greater responsibility to the public at whole. Broadmeadow raises for the first time in its reply brief the concept that 9305 subsection 8, although it speaks to appeals, is not actually about appeals. It's about maintaining an action invoking the jurisdiction of the Superior Court against the state of Delaware. In discussing Article 1, Section 9 of the Delaware Constitution, both parties discuss at length the first sentence of that section, that all courts are open and all persons injured have the ability to enter into the courts to redress their injuries. However, it is the last sentence of that section that is most applicable here, that which holds that suits against the state may only be brought when permitted by law. And in their reply brief in footnote 7 on page 9, when they first mentioned the NBC Realty case, what Broadmeadow does is it demonstrates exactly where I believe the problem lies, and that is there is a conflation of two standards for waiving sovereign immunity here. The APA sets this out very nicely. There is a standard for determining standing if an entity or a person wants to challenge a state agency's promulgation of a regulation, and then there is a standard for determining if there's been a waiver of sovereign immunity for addressing a case decision. And the NBC Realty case, that Maryland case that's cited by Broadmeadow, demonstrates where I believe the confusion lies. The NBC Realty case was a case about a certificate of need holder challenging a regulatory action taken by that agency. And that is not the situation that we have here. The Administrative Procedures Act 10141 allows any person aggrieved by a regulation change to file an action. That's the waiver of sovereign immunity. It's extremely broad. And it applies to the Health Resources Management Board, even though they're not an enumerated agency, pursuant to 10161 subsection B of the APA. But standing to challenge a case decision in courts is a much different process. And the APA requires that you look to the enabling statute here, 9305 subsection 8. You've heard a lot of argument on that. It applies to the applicant only. That's consistent with the APA, that waives sovereign immunity for challenging a case decision with regard to any person against whom a case is decided. So we have consistency there.
Does that mean, in essence, that there is no property right argument under the state constitution that's applicable here? And if there is one, it has to be under the federal constitution?
Once you hold a license or a certificate, Your Honor, you do have a property interest in that certificate or that license. However, that property interest is to be protected against actions by the state that directly affect your ability to use and implement that license. It is not the Equal Protection Clause, the Due Process Clause, they do not contemplate protection of a property interest in a market share or in a certain level of profit.
About the viability to act under your certificate of need and provide a service that it's been determined to be needed by the community?
Excellent question, Chief. Thank you. Viability, long-term viability of a applicant is still a criteria that the Health Resources Management Board must look at when determining whether or not to issue a certificate of need. The Health Resources Management Board is a 21-member board made up of subject matter experts spelled out in the code as to all the different industries that they represent. We need a majority of a quorum of those subject matter experts, and one of the things that they have to decide out of those seven enumerated criteria is the long-term viability of any applicant. So, as I stand here today, I am not qualified to tell you whether there is actual competition between a intensive rehabilitation facility and a nursing home. But what I do know is that the courts have long recognized the subject matter expertise of agencies and individual board members and the necessity of relying on that skill set to make those determinations.
But in all of that, we recognize special expertise, that doesn't necessarily mean that there's no review at all.
Absolutely not. There is the ability to challenge an action by a state agency if the agency has acted ultra vires. It's an extremely high standard, and it's a very difficult standard to overcome. The interesting position that we find ourselves in here today...
And the route to do that would be what? In this case, what would be the route to do that?
I believe that there's not only the Chancery Court option of seeking an injunction, not pursuant to 9303A, but the separate line of cases discussed earlier that's available whenever a citizen wishes to challenge an action of the government.
What about certiorari?
Certiorari, as well at the Superior Court level, is it appears to also be an option when an individual is challenging an action of the state government. Whether or not that's an option in this particular case with these particular parties, I guess is an open question that we're waiting for the Superior Court to decide. But in general, certiorari is certainly available, and it has, again, an extremely high bar because of the sovereign immunity concerns of Article 1, Section 9.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to first turn to the viability argument that Your Honor raised. In the record in this case is an affidavit of Mr. Schaefer, who points out that when a healthcare facility falls below 90% occupancy, the state penalizes it by reducing the amount of reimbursement paid per bed. And healthcare economics are different from marketplace economics, but a reduction in revenue makes it harder to maintain the quality of healthcare service. So that does affect viability. It is an important part of the license. The question is that Justice Berger raised about the protection of the right. We are not claiming a right to be free from competition. And I also note that in the DP&L case, this court found that the fact that DP&L did not have an exclusive franchise did not mean it did not have other valuable property rights. One of the property rights we are saying in this case is the requirement that if we're going to lose our exclusive franchise, it has to be done according to law. And our argument is that we are appealing because we are claiming that there are certain violations of law. That is the right we are claiming is violated. That is the injury in this case. Turning to Justice Ridge's question about certiorari, going back to Article 1, Section 9, we have cited cases from other courts which have a similar provision which state that it must require an appeal from an administrative proceeding. And in the Allison case, I want to quote briefly from the Colorado's, let me make sure I'm saying correctly, the Colorado Supreme Court en banc. It stated, a review of a certiorari petition is not sufficient to satisfy the constitutional requirement of access to the courts, which mandates review on the merits. The right of review guaranteed by the right of access to the courts, therefore, means a review on the merits. And for that reason, they found that certiorari is not an adequate substitute. And to the extent that a chancery action is limited in some way, as Mr. Allingham suggested, then that is not an adequate remedy either.
Not an adequate remedy to show that, if you can, that the action, the state action here was arbitrary and capricious?
It may be a remedy. I'm not sure. When Mr. Allingham stood up and said that there are restrictions, it's a high bar for a chancery action. He seemed to suggest that there is a limitation to the scope of review in the chancery proceeding. I don't know that that's true or not, but to the extent he is suggesting it to the court, it is something less than a review on the merits, then a chancery proceeding would not be adequate. But if it allows a full discussion of the addressing of the merits of the claims of violations, then As I said, we would be happy to go there. Unless Your Honors have any questions?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.
Thank you.